Sorry, dude. They were on our wish list. He yawns and stretches. But I do have a car in the parking garage, and I love to drive. Fast. Nine and I grab as much as we can from the weapons room, stuffing two large duffel bags full of rifles, handguns, and grenades. I pick up a rocket launcher, but Nine says it won't fit in the trunk. We need the remaining space for ammo. Next, we race to the surveillance room to grab the tablet. Nine sits down and starts punching keys at one of the computers. I have to shut this sucker down. Wouldn't want any of it to be useful to someone who isn't welcome. Do me a favor. While I'm dealing with this, check on the guard with that tablet thing. I press the blue circle in the upper corner and wait. I see our two radiating blue dots in Chicago. Then I see one in northern New Mexico, and there's still one in Jamaica. I wait a few seconds for the other three to appear, but they don't. Nine? I only see four, I say, my voice rising in panic. There are only four blue dots! He rips the tablet out of my hand. Let me see it. They must somehow be off the grid, Nine says. He doesn't sound so sure of himself all of a sudden. He presses the green triangle, and the green pulsing dots show up on the map in New Mexico and Egypt, just like before. At least the missing three didn't take one of the ships. I look closer and press the blue circle again. I realize the blue dot in New Mexico is now at the exact same spot as the green dot. That guard in New Mexico is on top of a ship. If that is a ship. Hope whoever that is knows it would be one lonely flight, Nine says. I shake my head at him and look back at the screen, trying to figure out what our next move should be. Then it hits me. Wait. The government is involved in all this somehow, right? What else is in New Mexico? Area 51. Is that where this green dot is? The most well-known place for UFO sightings? It's all starting to come together. Nine pulls the keyboard closer and starts tapping even more quickly. Cool your jets, cowboy. First of all, Area 51 is in Nevada. Second, we aliens? No, that place is just a decoy. It's a meaningless airplane hangar, give or take. A map of New Mexico appears on the main screen, and Nine zooms in on the northern half. Okay. Wait a second. He looks from the tablet back to the computer screen. Now this is interesting. You weren't that far off, after all. We may not be headed for Area 51, but we are going someplace just as secret. What do you mean? I ask while I wonder why I'm always playing catch-up with this guy. Nine pushes his chair away from the desk with an annoyingly satisfied grin on his face. Holy shit. That all makes sense now. He stabs the screen with his finger. In this part of New Mexico, there's a town in the middle of the desert called Dulce. Is any of this ringing familiar? No? Dulce, as in the infamous underground Dulce base, run by the one and only U.S. government? That must be where our ship is. Now I'm positive those are our ships blinking away on that screen. In their perfect wisdom, the government feeds the rumors about Area 51, so all the UFO freaks stay away from the real deal in Dulce. I can't help but smile. So now we're going to an underground government base. I certainly hope so, Nine says, shutting down the computer. He practically takes a bow, so pleased with himself for figuring all this out. Although it's supposed to be insanely secure and completely impossible to get into. And that's why it's the perfect place to hide our ship. Or to hide the random aliens you find during the course of your travels, I add. It feels as if everything has been turned upside down since I woke up. We quickly get moving, piling the weapons, our chests, and the supplies in the elevator. BK barely squeezes in with us as the elevator doors close. Nine surprises me with how gentle he sounds when he addresses the closed doors.
You are a sweet home, Chicago. I hope I see you again.
We descend rapidly.
Hey, man, I say.
Remember, our real home is so much cooler.
He doesn't say anything, but I see his shoulders relax.
The elevator doors open into an underground garage. We pause and carefully look around before we start to unload. With the coast clear, Nine and I throw the bags over our shoulders and BK follows. As we turn a corner, I see we're headed for a car hidden under a dusty tarp. After the luxury of the apartment, I can only imagine what must lurk beneath it. I can picture a yellow Ferrari, or something equally flashy. Or maybe it's a white convertible Porsche, or even a black Lotus. Nine must have read my thoughts. He winks at me and yanks the tarp off to reveal our ride. There, in all its glory, sits an old, beat-up beige Ford Contour. Not exactly the pimped-out ride I was expecting, but bling is now the least of my concerns. This thing doesn't look like it'll even start.
Are you serious?
I asked, not even bothering to hide my disgust. Nine looks at me innocently, even though he clearly knew what I was expecting.
What? You were hoping for a Camaro?
Not exactly, but I was hoping for something with less rust spots. Something that looks less determined to die, I say.
Shut up and get in, Johnny,
he says, tossing his bags into the trunk.
You ain't seen nothing yet.
Chapter 22. I wake to the sensation of rocking back and forth. Everything hurts. My whole body feels fried by the sun. My throat, my skin, my feet, and my head. My lips are so dry and burned I can't even put them together. My eyelids are the worst of all, and they refuse to open, no matter how desperately I want to see where I am. The rocking and swaying continues, and it dawns on me I must be in a moving vehicle. I try to lift my hands to my head, but that's when I discover they're tied down. So are my legs. Now I'm wide awake, and I force my eyes open and look madly around, but all I see is darkness. I close my eyes again. The desert sun must have left me blind. I try to call out for help, but all I can do is wheeze and cough. My ears pick up an echo, and I concentrate on the air around me. I cough again, just to hear the echo once more. It's enough sound to understand I'm in a tight space and that the space around me is made of metal. It feels like I'm in a coffin, and I almost retch. That's when I start to panic. What if I'm not blind? What if I'm really dead? I can't be. I am in way too much pain to be dead. But I feel buried alive. My breath starts to come fast and furious when a man's voice stops my panic attack cold. It's loud and electronic, coming through a speaker. Are you awake? I try to answer him, but my throat is too dry. I tap my fingers on the bench and realize it's metal, too. A few seconds later, there is a noise to my right, and I can sense something has been placed near me. There's a glass of water and a straw beside you. Take a sip, the man says. I turn my head and find the straw with my mouth. The skin on my lips cracks as I try to close them around the straw. When I take a sip of water, I can taste the metallic tinge of blood, and I hear a low humming in my ears. It's the same hum I heard at the gate. The box I'm in must be flowing with electricity. What were you doing at that gate? The man asks. Every time he speaks, I'm struck by how neutral his voice is. It isn't friendly, but neither is it threatening. Lost, I whisper. I was lost. How did you get lost? I take another sip before saying, I don't know. You don't know. I see. Your number is 6, is it not? I cough and choke at the question, mentally chewing myself out for doing so. I'm usually cooler than this, but my mind is completely cooked by the sun. If he wasn't sure of the answer before, he is now. I resolve to get a grip to stop making stupid mistakes. The voice is back. Well, number 6, you're pretty famous around here. The footage from the high school in Paradise and the way you took down those helicopters in Tennessee was impressive. And then there's the incredible show you put on in D.C. last week, breaking John Smith and Sam Good out of a federal facility. You are quite the little warrior princess, aren't you? I'm still stuck on how he could know who I am. Now he's talking like he had front row seats to my life. My body sways hard to the left. The vehicle must have taken a turn, taking me who knows where. I push against the strap over my forehead. Nothing happens. I try using my telekinesis, but as soon as I even start to focus my thoughts, pain rolls through my stomach so bad I almost throw up. What you need to do is relax. Trying to fight isn't going to get you anywhere. You're dehydrated, and most likely have heat stroke. You're going to feel pretty sick for a while. Who are you? I manage to ask painfully. Agent David Purdy, FBI, he says. I feel slightly better knowing I'm in the hands of the U.S. government, not captured by the Moogs. I couldn't go through that again, knowing what was coming, especially now that the charm that protected me the first time has been broken. With the FBI, my chances of survival have just skyrocketed. No matter how aggressive they aren't monsters. All I need right now is a little patience. The opportunity to escape will come. Purdy doesn't know that, probably assumes it can't be true. Right now, I'll just follow his advice. Relax. Rehydrate. Wait. I might as well see what else he's willing to tell me about what he knows about me, what he knows about all of this. Where am I? I ask. The speaker squeals before Agent Purdy answers. You're in a transport. It's a short trip. Again, I try to use my telekinesis to undo my leg straps, but I'm still too weak, and the attempt makes me nauseous again. I take another couple of sips of water to give myself time to think. Where are you taking me? We've got a reunion planned for you with a friend. Or maybe I should say a friend of John Smith's. Do you call him John? Or do you call him Number 4? I pause before answering. I don't know what you're talking about, I say. I don't know anyone named John 4. All of a sudden, I remember what happened back in the desert, just before I blacked out at the gate. I felt half out of my mind, so much so I wasn't even sure if the helicopters landing close by were real. I remember hearing Ella's voice. No, I didn't just hear her voice. We spoke to each other. She asked, I answered. Given the fact that it's the FBI who has me, it's a pretty good bet there really were helicopters. If those were real, maybe I did communicate with Ella. Has a new legacy kicked in? Just when I needed it most. Ella, can you hear me? I try again, just in case. The FBI is holding me. An agent named Purdy has me locked up and we're in some kind of vehicle. Purdy says it isn't far, wherever it is we're going. How did you get to the desert, Number 6? Purdy's voice interrupts. Weren't you just in India with your friends? Remember that? Just like all the other kids reading school books and being kidnapped at the airport. How does he know that? How did you know where the base was? His voice is losing a bit of its neutrality. I think I hear just a hint of impatience. What base? I ask. I'm having a hard time thinking straight. The one we found you dying outside of in the desert. How did you know where to find it? I try to turn invisible. But again, the moment I try testing my legacy, my stomach erupts with a ferocious and immediate pain. I want so badly to curl up in a ball, but the straps hold me flat and the pain takes my breath away. Drink your water, the agent advises again. His voice is back to its detached neutrality. Just as I did the first time, I obey, take a sip, and wait. The pain finally starts to dull, but then a powerful wave of dizziness washes over me. My mind feels like it's a car careening out of control, swerving this way and that. The thoughts, too many of them to be coherent, come fast and furious. The events from the last few days flash by me. I see myself taking hold of Marina's arm right before we teleported. I see Creighton lying motionless. I watch myself saying goodbye to John and Sam. I almost forget where I am. That is, until the voice forces me back to my present circumstances. Where is number four? He is nothing if not consistent, this guy. Who? I ask, forcing myself to focus on what he's saying. If I don't, I'm going to make another mistake like I did before. All of a sudden, the calm voice is completely gone. He screams through the speaker. Where is number four? I wince at the noise. Go to hell, I spit. I'm not telling him anything. Ella, Marina, anyone? If anyone can hear me, you need to say something. I need help. I'm in some desert. All I know is I'm near a U.S. government base, and the FBI has me. We're going somewhere, but I don't know where. And there's something wrong with me. I can't use my legacies. Who was with you in India, number six? Who were the man and the two girls? I stay silent. I picture Ella's face. The youngest Lorian left. I know how that must weigh on her. And now she's without Creighton. It was just a day ago I was jealous of what they had, and now he's gone. What numbers were they? Who were the girls? Agent Purdy sounds impatient, though his voice is calmer now. That's my band. I play the drums. They sing. I love Josie and the Pussycats, don't you? I like to watch retro cartoons. All the kids are doing it. My lips crack and bleed again when I smile. I don't mind. I taste my blood on my tongue and smile wider. Six? The man asks in a gentler voice. I guess he's going to try the good cop tactic. Was that number five and seven you were with at the airport in India? Who is the older man? Who are the girls? Suddenly, it's as if I can't control what comes out of my mouth. My voice doesn't even sound like mine when I say, Marina and Ella, they're sweet, sweet girls. I just wish they were a little stronger. What am I saying? Why am I saying anything? Are Marina and Ella members of your race? Why do they need to be stronger? And what number is Marina? I catch myself this time before answering, shocked that I even opened my mouth to answer again. I concentrate all my energies to find my voice, to respond as I know I should. It's like I'm battling a war within me. I don't know what you're talking about. Why do you keep talking about numbers? Agent Purdy's voice blasts into the box. I know who you are. You're from another planet. I know you kids go by numbers. We have your ship, for Christ's sake. At the mention of our ship, my mind starts to spin. I flash back to the journey from Lorien. I see myself as just a kid, staring out the ship's windows at the emptiness of space as we travel towards Earth. I eat at a long white table and look at the other eight kids, each with their sapons. There's a boy with long black hair laughing and throwing food. A blonde girl sits next to him, quietly eating a piece of fruit. The sapons at the end of the table watch the kids closely. I see a young Marina crying, her legs tucked up to her chest, sitting on the floor under a control panel. Her Sepan is on her knees next to her, trying to coax her to stand up with her. I remember I